Then we will go to another hot topic. If economic growth and rise to riches is a hot topic, also conflict is one. And there's lots of territorial conflict in East Asia. And one of the places, one of the hottest places is South China Sea, South China Sea. In terms of natural environment, it's simply a fairly wide expanse of water here between Vietnam, the Philippines, China, and Malaysia. In practice, things are much hotter there. These two addresses are places where you can find very interesting maps of this area. Nansha organization is a Chinese one, and you can navigate there if you can know a few Chinese characters. And the other one is an English one, English language one. Anyway, interesting places, both of them. China is the problem here. This is the first official Chinese governmental map of the South China Sea and Chinese area there. It's a so-called 11-dash map, because the boundary there's no clear boundary, but there's an approximate boundary shown by this kind of dashes in this map. And I have here used Jyrki Kallio's very fine study, Kiinan meri vai kaikkien meri, from the Foreign Institute of International Affairs, Finnish Institute of International Affairs. You can find it, and I think you can find also an English version in the internet if you go to look for it. So here we have 11 dashes. 1947 meant that it was still during the Chinese internal war. And China would have had no possibilities, no capabilities to actually control this thing. It was based on earlier Chinese ideas about the defensive area around China, which go back to the 19th century. At a time when colonial powers were coming to China and taking pieces here and there, it was sensible for the Qing Manchu government to claim areas far away as Chinese possessions, so that, one, they would perhaps be taken first and colonial powers might be satisfied with them. Second, you claim everything you can, and perhaps something remains. So it is an old history, and also in 1947, probably those who made these dashes didn't think too closely what they were doing. They simply made those dashes somewhere in the maps. The problem is that it goes along the coasts of all of these nations here, and in the south, it is very, very far away from China proper. But once you have an official map, then it has a staying power. And it still is in contemporary Chinese maps. It is now a 9-dash map, because here the Gulf of Tonkin boundary has been delineated with Vietnam. It has been decided by mutual agreement. So now you have only 9 dashes. But it still takes the whole area into Chinese possession. Two things. One, China has declined to explain what does this mean in practice. And second, it is not a continuous line. It is not like this. But it's still these dashes. And China has also declined to explain what does this mean. And we will come back to this a bit late. But China has been quite active in many of these. Well, there are small islands, rocks, atolls. Not big in terms of land, but what we have there is some amount of oil, perhaps also natural gas, just lots of fish, and important sea lanes. Basically, most of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese trade to Europe, Africa, Middle East, go through this area. So it has lots of strategic importance, and who controls it controls a lot. China is the only one that is making big claims. The Chinese simply are the most, how should we say, surrealistic, the most biggest one. So China is this red line here. Vietnamese claims, this yellow line here, is also quite big. It is also claiming most of the area. Malaysia is here, this violet line, also fairly far, a bit more than halfway towards Vietnam, but not as outrageous. The Philippines are claiming this blue line here, also quite far above the middle of this of these straits. Yes, and that's it. Ah, Brunei, this small sultanate, is also claiming only a small section, but also quite deeply to the center. Indonesia is also claiming here something. There has been Chinese claims have sometimes went also to somewhere here, but they don't seem to do that nowadays. Indonesia simply said quite strongly that no. So that seems to be the case nowadays. When you look at who is nowadays occupying the central parts of these places, that Vietnam actually is having most of these areas, the biggest area. But China is quite near Vietnam even here, because this is the Chinese flag. And China is pretty strong here, here in the more northern part. Taiwan is occupying here two small islands. The Philippines are here, and here the Philippines and Vietnam and China and also Taiwan, they are very closely mixed together. And then we have Malaysians basically here, not advancing too much to the fray. The biggest tensions and actual conflicts have taken place between China and Vietnam and China and Philippines. There have been actual naval battles where in case of Vietnam, ships have been shot down to the bottom of the sea, and that was in the 1988. And recently there has been, more recently there has been fire also between Chinese and Vietnamese boats and Chinese and Filipino boats. Coast guards rather than warships. But anyway, the situation is tense. And basically all these ASEAN countries, their leadership and their citizens are angry towards China about this. Especially Vietnam and the Philippines are in this situation. There have been public demonstrations in both countries against Chinese and Chinese practices in the South China Sea. If we think again, this idea of imperial space and how a modern nation state understands its space. Modern nation state has a clearly defined boundary. Which is controlled strongly by the state. And imperial space is quite much looser in its outskirts. Jyrki Kallio suggested in his paper that perhaps China would be satisfied with a situation where ASEAN countries, each individually, would simply accept and announce publicly that they accept Chinese sovereignty in this area. And after that, China might be willing to engage into cooperative systems, let Vietnam take in an Indian company to drill oil in one part of the area, do the same with the Filipinos and so on. That would mean that a demand that Southeast Asian countries again would accept a suzerain position vis-à-vis Imperial China, which was a situation still in the from the 15th and 16th and 17th, 18th, sometimes even in the 19th century. As long as they were independent political entities in Southeast Asia. Which would mean that a kind of imperial mentality is breeding in the Chinese high administration. This has not happened. None of these ASEAN states has given this kind of proclamations. They tend to view the situation in terms of modern nation state because they are building themselves as modern nation states nowadays. The Chinese position seems to be that because they once were a great imperial power, then they were 150 years old, very bad, even evil situation vis-à-vis the rest of the world. Now it is the right of China to come to its former position. So there is a moral righteousness in Chinese discussion and mentality. You feel it when you discuss with Chinese nowadays. They talk about their right to correct the evils done to China during the colonial and post-colonial, even the post-colonial period. Vietnam especially is doing national unification at this moment with an anti-Chinese agenda. China is the biggest enemy. Perhaps this is strongest in Vietnam nowadays, because Vietnam has a long history of having wars against China, sometimes being conquered, then liberated again. It resembles quite much Finnish history with Russia, but perhaps with even more emotional intensity nowadays, because it's a long time since Finland fought a war with Russia or Soviet Union, but 1978, there was a war between China and Vietnam, and the Vietnamese have not forgiven that. And 1988, this naval warfare, a naval battle between China and Vietnam. So it is still in fresh memory. But also in other ASEAN states, there are these kind of problems. There was an ASEAN plus three meeting in Phnom Penh, where also this regional economic partnership was put, this idea was put into place. But there was also an interesting quarrel between the Chinese, was it president or prime minister, who visibly got angry on ASEAN ideas on this. And this is something new because normally in these high-level diplomatic meetings, everything has been extremely polite thus far. But the situation is getting more and more tense. One reason being that now the Chinese are becoming richer. They want to eat better. And they want to eat fish every now and then. And because there are so many people in China, the near coastal waters near China have been fished almost empty, and fish levels have collapsed there. They have to go more out. And South China Sea is one place where to do this. So everything, all conflicts that take place there is not between states, but you have lots of Chinese fishers, fishing ships, fishing boats, fishing illegally on places that other states don't accept. Then you have the coastal patrols of these states driving those boats away, or embarking on the ship, and taking the captains, the crew, perhaps to judgment. And you have then Chinese patrol boats trying to help the Chinese fishing boats. And this is where the one place where the big dynamics come from. At this moment, because all of these ASEAN states, these big ASEAN states are quite poor, they don't have big navies with big warships. Also, China is only building a big navy. So they have no, excepting this small battle with Vietnam a couple of decades ago, there are no big warships circling in the area much. So there have been no great military confrontations. It's basically these patrol boats with other patrol boats. So no big warfare has erupted there. Of course, there's also tension between Vietnam and the Philippines and so on. But the same situation, no big maritime armies have been confronting each other. But China is the common problem for all these states. Let's move northwards to East China Sea. It's called Eastern Sea by the Chinese, sometimes Eastern China State Sea, which brings the state also here. Koreans call it Southern Sea. And Chinese like to use this kind of maps, these maps, and all maps from here onwards until I say something else, are from Wikipedia. This from Chinese Wikipedia, which shows the continental shelf so clearly, as if as a natural continuation of the Chinese mainland. Which means that Taiwan, of course, but also the Okinawa Prefecture, the Ryukyu Islands here, seems to be part of natural China, even Japan itself. Japanese call it, they used to call it Higashi Shinakai, Western China Sea, before the Second World War. Then they turned into Western China State Sea after the Second World War. But now they use Higashi Shinakai again. This is the form that Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs recommends. The difference here is that this way of writing it implies that, what does it imply? This would imply the China as a state here. And it will connect the China as a state closely with this maritime area. This does not, because China here is only a sound. It is the name that Westerners use about China, but nothing else. So it does, it slightly less makes China present in the area in terms of name politics? Okay. The conflict, and there's also a big conflict going on here, is about these islands here, which don't even show in this map, but they are in this area. This is the Ryukyu Islands, or Okinawa Prefecture, and there's not so much dispute about this nowadays. It goes all the way from Kyushu Island to here, near Taiwan, and this is okay. But here is the conflict at this moment. Japanese call it Senkaku Shoto, or Senkaku Retto. Both names here is written as Shoto. You can see it here. And the Chinese call it Diaoyutai. And this, the rest of it means that other islands connected with that. And the Taiwanese call it Tiaoyutai. And that's this. So different names in different countries. Taiwanese and Chinese both are of the opinion and they belong to China and not to Japan. A bigger map. So this is the Okinawa Prefecture and not under quarrel at the moment. And these are the small places. Nobody lives here. They are so small islands that nobody is living there. And here again, the normal scenario is that we have Chinese fishing boats coming to these islands and Japanese coastal patrol driving them away. 2010, 2 years ago, a Chinese fishing boat captain rammed his ship on the side of a Japanese coastal patrol boat. Didn't you a situation where the Japanese boarded the ship, took the crew captive, and took them to Japan proper to be sentenced in front of a judge? And this is where Chinese nationalism woke. There were big demonstrations in China. And the normal burning of Japanese cars and breaking of the windows of Japanese shops or Japanese companies. And the tension has been very high ever since. Now, three of these islands happen to be owned by a private person. I don't know who he is. His name has not been in the newspapers. But he lives somewhere near Tokyo. And the Tokyo mayor, Ishihara Shintaro, decided that it's best that the Tokyo city buys these islands from their owner so that they would be in public, they would be public property. He said this last summer and started collecting money to buy these islands. He's a right-wing person who likes to make the Chinese angry and who can make quite outrageous statements. In this situation, the Japanese government decided that it is better that the Japanese state buys the rest, these three islands. It was already possessing all the others. And bought them in September, last autumn. The result, again, furious Chinese uprisings, burning of Japanese cars, a boycott of Japanese goods, breaking of the windows of Japanese shops, Japanese restaurants, Japanese companies. Some violence against Japanese nationals, and so on. Japanese being also terribly angry about this. The Chinese are nowadays, if you have public opinion polls, which nationality do you like the least? The Japanese like least the Chinese, nowadays. The situation is difficult. There are about 20,000 Japanese companies active in China, employing about 10 million Chinese people. And there are about 20,000 Japanese students in China, and about 70,000, perhaps 80,000 Chinese students in Japan. And there used to be lots of tourist movement between these countries. And all this is quite difficult now. The Japanese Prime Minister Noda said, it was in October, that the Chinese reaction to this thing, it was hysterical, which again rose the ire of the Chinese. And they have been quarreling ever since. In the past few weeks, everything has been silent here. It appears that the Chinese government has strictly ordered Chinese fishing boats to stay outside of the area. You have to try to balance this situation. But this is not the first one. These things have been going on for a long time. And it will not be the last one. There will be other ones also. From a Japanese point of view, this is a map that I took from Japanese Security Report by Japanese, what was this? Institute of Defense Studies, 2011. If you think of China, here below, this is China, which is becoming stronger. What does China strategically think? It thinks about the USA and USA Navy, which is supreme in all of the oceans of the world. The Chinese want a defense line, the way to keep the American Navy to come on the Chinese coast. The USA has been doing surveillance cruises quite near the Chinese coast here, and Chinese are trying to keep them out. If we had this Ryukyu Island chain here, it is thought of as the first defense line, coming from Japan here, then to Philippines, and the South China Sea is also within this. And the second defense line would start from Japan here and go all the way to Guam, which is an American military base, and then go to Papua New Guinea. If this was the practical Chinese defense line, then US would have to stay far, far away and not come near at all. So China is building a so-called, Blue Ocean Navy, a navy that can travel far to the oceans of the world, meaning big ships. And it has just built, using an old Soviet one, a ship where you can also transport airplanes. It is the first one, but not completely Chinese made. So it is still far away from doing it, but it has a number of big ships and a number of submarines. From last year onwards, China have been conducting two naval exercises here, within these red dots, one in June and one in November. And how to get there is that when you start from here, they have used the Miyako Strait and then gone here. And when they go there, they have to go through Japanese territorial waters. And the Chinese military does not like this. It would be much nicer if the Ryukyu chain was within Chinese control. If they did not go there, they would have to sail all the way south from Taiwan and then come here, which is much longer way, or via South Korean space and here to the northern part of Japan, which is also a long way. This is the straight way. It would be nice in terms of Chinese military thinking if it was Chinese possession. So the Japanese think that if they give up in the case of the Sengaku, Ryukyu Islands, Ryukyu Islands would be the next one. So the Sengaku Islands are a kind of defense line for the Japanese against expanding Chinese naval power. Chinese military leadership or Chinese state leadership has never publicly accepted this kind of defense line thinking exists. You can read it in old pre-social China publications. Chiang Kai-shek has written about this. And you can find it also in 19th century Chinese military thinking, that it was the ocean, these are the lines. It exists in the history, but it is not said publicly. But anyway, this is a larger idea that comes up in Japanese discussions. Okay, let's move again northwards. China and South Korea. Again, problem. According to the United Nations Law of Sea, a convention which is an international legal document signed by more than 100 states of the world, I think about 160 states of the world, almost all maritime states except the United States, which doesn't want to be bounded by any kind of legal hassles. But China is part of it, Korea is part of it, Japan is also part of it, no problem there. According to this law, states can declare 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone outside of their coasts, where they have the right to fish and bore the sea bottom to find if there is oil or minerals or whatever. And because Korea and China are so near each other, their 200 mile exclusive economic zones are overlapping in places. They should draw it along some kind of central line, but they have not been willing to do that. They have been negotiating that for many times, but no specific conclusion has been accepted. The reason may be more on the Chinese side. China is not so willing to enter into any kind of binding agreements because it knows that its power is growing, growing, and growing, more than that of any of its neighbors. One problem is here, where there is lots of diplomatic disagreement. There is a rock. It's not above surface. Even in low tide, it is about 4 meters below the surface. But South Koreans know that it is on their side of the central line, and they have built a structure there. Some kind of observation building. And Chinese don't like this. But that is on the diplomatic level. Another problem is that here we have a big island, Jeju Island. And the South Koreans are building there a big naval bay, base. enough so that you can put even 20 fairly big ships there, and also submarines. It would control access here and also to the Chinese Sea. Yellow Sea, this is called. And would help lots also here in controlling these Korean coastal waters, because there's lots of conflict there. Chinese don't like this either. But what is happening here is we have again fishing vessels. Lots of Chinese fishing vessels. In the case of the Diaoyutai Sengoku Islands, nobody has died thus far. Here on the South Korean area, people have died. The number of fishing vessels there is very large. And was it about a year ago, one South Korean border guard was killed with a spade when he was entering a Chinese fishing ship. Before that, South Koreans did not wear weapons, fire weapons, when they were entering these Chinese ships. Now they do. They are still shooting only rubber bullets, but a few months ago, a Chinese fisher sailor was killed by a rubber bullet. They can also kill. Again, a similar situation where illegal fisher boat is there, South Korean Coast Guard is entering the ship, there's a person, was it a knife or a saw, anyway a kind of weapon, and attacking it, and then the guard shot. And this kind of incidents leading to death or serial wounding have taken place many times in the past. During the past 10 years there have been about 4,000 Chinese fishing ships detained by South Korean coast guards. Their number is rising by the year, and the South Korean government calculated, but this year, 2012, it has not yet ended, but the count is probably 600. And you can catch only a part of them. Most of them escape. So the push to South Korea is strong in terms of these private Chinese fishers. However, this is not a diplomatic problem. Even though fishermen die and the Coast Guard dies here, it is not a case of demonstrations in China. Korean cars are not being burned. It is very slow, silent, peaceful, diplomatically. So Korea is being treated completely different way than Japan is. It seems that special humbleness is being demanded of Japan. The reason perhaps being it that while China was for hundreds of years the eminent state in this area, for 100 years, from the early 20th century to about these days, Japan used to be the top country. It eclipsed China for a while. And it seems that special humbleness is demanded of Japan, because the domestic reaction in China is so different. And even against Vietnam or Malaysia or Philippines, there's no public outrage, but it's always Japan where this happens. And nobody has yet died. But potentially, situation here is more dangerous, because both Korea and Japan, they have real strong maritime armies, navies, they are called in English, and China also. So if something bad happens, there's lots of iron that can be used. But dust fight always has been so especially between Japan and China, the tensions have escalated. And then they have been taken under control again. And this may go on and on for a long time to come. There's no end in sight. More words between South Korea and Japan. There's here Japan, here South Korea, quite in the middle, but a bit on the South Korean side. It's a couple of very small islands. As far as I know, nobody living there at the moment. In English, they are called Ryukyu Rocks, Tokdo in Korean, and Takeshima in Japanese. Tokdo means lonely island, and Takeshima means bamboo island in Japanese. These are controlled by South Koreans. Japanese demand them, and there's some quarreling between fishing boats, but nothing like there between China and these countries. This is not a big issue. This is an existing tension, which means quarreling, but this is not a big issue. Neither of these countries are expanding so much as China is doing. Northwards, there's a long-time issue there. The so-called Northern Territories, as Japanese call them, or Southern Kuril Islands, as the Russians call them, Yuzhnyi Kurilsky Ostrobov, if I can pronounce it right, Hopporyodo in Japanese. This conflict goes back to the end of the Second World War, with Japan lost, and it lost also this whole Kuril Island chain. Now, the Japanese accepted that the Soviet Union can take this part, but not these three islands and one island group. Because this group used to be part of the administration of Hokkaido. So Japanese think of them separate from the real Kuril Island. Well, again, here there is some Japanese sailing boats going there and fishing and so on, but not much. Japan is not so dependent on the near coastal waters like the Chinese are, because the Japanese have very good fishing fleets. They go out to the wide oceans, even to the Atlantic, and they freeze the fish there and then transport back to Japan. And most of Japanese military power at this lot of it used to be here in Hokkaido, because there's a boundary between Soviet Union and Japan, and nowadays Russia and Japan. Now the military power is being taken southwards, towards where China is. Japan and Soviet Union never made a peace treaty, and Japan and Russia have never made a peace treaty. They are not actually in a situation of warfare between themselves, but the peace treaty has never been made. In the 1990s, after Soviet Union collapsed, there was discussion and more or less an agreement that if they make a peace treaty, perhaps these islands, or perhaps two of them, perhaps all of them, can be returned to Japan, and then lots of Japanese investment will flow to Siberia to develop it and renovate the old Soviet time technologies. But this has not happened. This is nowadays a big issue in Russia, not to give any single part of Russian national territory to any foreign power. And actually, President Dmitry Medvedev, visited this island, Kunashiri here. It's not Kunashiri. Anyway, this island, there's an airport here, and he drove there around in a car. There's photos of him being there. Establishing the fact that if the Russian president visits these islands, they cannot be returned back to China, back to Japan. So there's symbolical tension and activity here, but no military problems. This is quite peaceful. Problems are there where China is. Other places, there are disagreements and territorial disputes, but they are more peaceful. But China is where the problem lies. Let's take then finally a look at the political meaning of territorial conflict. What is it about? One is fish. One is oil and gas. Third is sea lanes, where you have freedom of movement. The fourth one is that economic integration, economic activity, trade, investment, so on, tends to bring countries closer together. And these quarrels tend to pull them apart, so you can control the situation by having both pushing and pulling factors. The fifth one is sovereignty, the national territory. What does it mean? And who owns it? Human beings are territorial beings, and when it enters national political psychology, emotions run high. Even a small island 10,000 kilometers far away can arouse intense feelings in Peterburg, near Finnish border. So there's something in land that fits human psychology, and especially this kind of large group psychology that nations have. And because this is so deep in the nations, and then you have newspapers and patriotic groups doing propaganda, so all government also have to go along with this. Otherwise, they look weak, and if you have to be elected or take care of legitimacy, if you appear weak, that is bad. And the sixth is imperial politics. This is being used. Well, if we have, as I said in the first lecture, global power comes from alliances, not from the military and economic power of a single state, but it comes from alliances. And it's difficult to think what this means in terms of China. In one sense, because it is not yet powerful enough to confront USA and will not be in the near future decades. If China would have an alliance, it would be a more natural opponent of the USA. And these quarrels are a way of keeping the nearby countries so far and so angered by China that it is not able to build any kind of alliance. It is one solitary state. And please remember that even North Korea is not an ally of China. It would be in a quite similar situation as Vietnam nowadays, if it was free in its movement and open to the rest of the world. Perhaps not so antagonistic, but anyway, not necessarily an ally of China. On the other hand, this is a way of trying and experimenting with each singular country, because China refuses to discuss these matters multilaterally, that all Southeast Asian countries would come to the same table with China and discuss together. China deals only with one country at a time in terms of these territorial disputes. So you have this giant and a small country at the same time. It is a way of exploring these countries, these hate and tensions and then peace, and then tension and then peace. Will they give up? When will they give up? Because you can create allies not only by co-opting so that they want to be your ally, but also by forcing them to be your ally. Sort of accept Chinese leadership over them and start speaking humbly towards China. There may be both things at the same time, because whatever you do, this would be quite long term, far away in the distance things. But China has been in existence about 2,000 years. They can think in terms of far distant future also. Well, these are speculations. I'm now 57 years old, and I may die away before I see the end of these speculations. But most of my listeners, you are young people, and at the time when you are being carried to your graves, you may know much more than I will do about this situation. Interesting future is be waiting for you.